You're now listening to La Verdad Podcast. Bueno, mi gente, welcome back to another episode of La Verdad Podcast. This is your host, Christian. And before I begin the podcast, I do want to mention one of our production team members. Her mom's actually collecting and doing a collection to send supplies over to Puerto Rico. She's actually sending school supplies. She's a teacher over in the Chicagoland area and definitely understands the needs that a lot of the students might have, or a lot of the teachers might have. A lot of times teachers are coming out of their pocket to pay for supplies. So she's doing a colecta. She has all the supplies now. She only needs help with sending the supplies to Puerto Rico, which she's going to hand deliver to Yaucoa over in the island. So if you guys want to donate, feel free to go to our page at www.laverdadltd.com or go to our Facebook page, and you'll see a post that we have put up there in regards to this little campaign that we got going on. So before also we begin, this is actually the first episode that we do with this collaboration that we have with the Segundo Ruiz Belvis Cultural Center, and I just named it like 10 minutes ago. And I'm going to call it El Backstage with Segundo Ruiz Belvis Cultural Center and La Verdad Podcast. And the first person, the first group that's actually joining us on this El Backstage series is Ife, coming straight from the island, right? Straight from Puerto Rico. How you been, man? How you doing?
Good. Came in, I guess, late last night and, you know, had a rehearsal here in the center today. And we're going to play kind of an acoustic set this evening.
Yeah.
And, then doing Navy Pier tomorrow afternoon, man. So.
Cool. I know it's definitely one of those things where it feels nonstop. As soon as you land, you're busy, you're doing things.
Yeah, we get it going pretty quickly.
Going straight to the hotel or where you're staying at, and then nonstop from there.
Sure. But, I mean, again, like, I grew up in Indiana. I love this area. A lot of the guys and girl, everyone from the group knows people in the Chicago area.
So, oh, really? Okay.
You know, so it's just it feels like we're, you know, in familia here. So
yeah, that's the great part too. Like when you're able to visit another area, and you just feel like you know people. You have the warmth of the people that you're visiting. I think it makes things a little bit it makes it fun. I guess. Right? It's not so much work or something like that.
Yeah, no, absolutely, man. It's great, and you know, just touching down in Chicago and hitting the hotel, going to eat with friends, and just, you know, it feels like you know, an opportunity more to touch base with the people that we know. And
love, you know. Now, let's talk about Ife. Let's just start with the most basic question: what does the name mean?
The name in Yoruba means love, but it can also be used for expansion.
Okay.
And when I was thinking about doing a sort of solo project, I had been a producer kind of in the hip hop scene first, and then later kind of in the indie rock scene in Puerto Rico, in San Juan. And I knew I wanted to do something for myself that would be like a solo project or something where I would maybe be writing the music, you know, or doing sort of the conception of the whole project. I tried to think about names, and I have, you know, kind of a past that's, you know, full of a lot of struggle and a bit of darkness, you know. And so the music I made before I made Ife was pretty dark stuff, man. Whatever, man. I kind of liken it to the difference between Dizzy and Coltrane. You know, I remember Coltrane saying something like that he wished he could be as lighthearted as Dizzy was and make something like that, but his music came from another place. And I feel a bit the same now. So when I was looking for names for the group, I liked the name La Macacoa, because that is something we use like as a curse when we're talking about, se cayó la macacoa. That's like, but I had heard somebody describe like a really sick rapper as La Macacoa. Ese tipo La Macacoa. Mm. And I loved it because it.
So they took that negative connotation
and made it like, you know, sort of like Michael Jackson using the word bad.
Super bad. And now everybody says, yo, that's bad, but it's actually good.
And so I like that. And I like the idea of being the curse, you know, because you already have like, you know, people are already scared of that.
Yeah.
But it's also something that you know, unless you're sort of dialed in, you may not be able to control something like, you know, out of your, you can't manage it, you know? And I like the idea of being unmanageable. However, I felt that at that time, and this was about 2013, that I was coming from a place that the music I wanted to make, I wanted to create like happiness and hope and love specifically. Okay. And so I was going through a group of images that I had, is inspirational images that I had on my computer, and I saw a photo from Life magazine, and immediately, you know, as a designer, I saw the logo for Life.
And, that's dope.
And I was like, wow, man, red and white, that's the colors of Django and the religion. Django is the owner of music and dance. So there, I'm trying to think, okay, well, what does Django want me to get from this image, you know? And then I just saw it. I was like, if you lop off the L, you get Ife, which means love and expansion.
Dope.
And I thought, okay, well, I got red and white, Django, music and dance. I got Ife, love and expansion. That's a really great, like, starting place to build a musical project around.
That's dope.
So I just tried to make it about love and expansion.
One of the things, too, like you mentioned, you know, listening to some of the, like, transitioning from this production side of like a dark side and adding some like different styles. I remember I used to play trumpet, right, for a very long time, and I remember there was an era that I was just listening to Miles Davis, but it was during his like time that he was doing a lot of free jazz, you know, and I was digging it, man. I was really getting into it, and then, but I also felt that it was playing with my emotions a little bit, right? I was always negative, kind of like not really in a straight path, and then I started listening to some other classical music and other types of jazz. So I feel like it plays a big influence into the way that you might act or react to certain things. So I like that. I like that idea of being able to transition your type of music, especially in a production side. One of the coolest things that I've seen from Ife too is the ability to take a traditional, like a rumba, traditional, you know, Afro-Cuban or an African beat, right, and adding this electronic side to it. If you guys haven't checked out any of the Ife's videos on YouTube, I will say check it out, or on their website as well, because it gives you an idea of the mind, of what's going through your mind and how you're creating these sounds. Let's talk a little bit about production. I love geeking out on that. Where did you sit back and say, hey, let me add a trigger or let me add MIDI onto this drum to make it sound how I want it to sound?
It was really problem solving more than anything else. I guess the music that I sort of, there's basically three genres that I sort of can't stop listening to. One would be Cuban rumba, the other one would be Jamaican dancehall, and the third would be jazz from like the hard bop era, maybe.
Okay. Yeah.
Right. So I, of course, I wasn't around when Dizzy was doing his thing, or Eric Dolphy, or Coltrane, or whatever, but those are my heroes, like American heroes, right? Because that's the only really like North American gringo music I named was jazz, right? So for me, when I think about that era, I remember too, like, you know, Coltrane talking about his critics, right? And sort of the point sort of being like, how can you criticize what I'm doing if you don't understand jazz?
Yeah.
You don't understand jazz like composition.
Yeah.
So if you can't understand what I'm doing, like, you just don't know where I'm going. You don't know like the rules that I'm breaking and like the new ground I'm coming to, right? Yeah. And so, but I do feel like the kids that were there that appreciated jazz did, right? And so it sort of, I imagine the jazz listener from those years as somebody that's smart enough to understand the language, you know, and demanding enough to sort of demand newness and freshness in their musicians and in the music, right? And so I wanted to make a music that was as demanding as that, but in a modern vernacular, right?
Yeah.
So I love the electronic sounds of modern music, but I don't love electronic music because it's boring to me being a drummer, right? So if I were to go see something like Justice or Chromeo or whatever, I assume that what I'm going to see is, you know, some guys with drum machines and keyboards, and they're just going to hit sort of play on the programming, play keyboards on top of it, saying it's okay, but like, I want to hear the beat improvise. And I've made this analogy too before, like, I like hip-hop, or I liked hip-hop, but I've always seen like the rapper improvise over a beat. I never saw the beat improvise over a rapper, you know? And so that's kind of what I wanted to do, was like, how do I make an electronic music that it's as nimble as jazz, sounds like today?
Yeah.
Like, I'm not interested in having different sounds from people. I want the same sounds that you know in modern music, but I'm going to use them in a different way, right? And that's kind of my thing. Like, I don't care if like that same snare is being used by Kanye or being used by so-and-so. Yeah, yeah. Like, I'm just going to make it work in a different context because I want kids to hear themselves in the music. You know, it's important that the... So for me, I wanted the music not to sound throwback. It couldn't sound like something the Daptones would make that was imitating an era. It has to be the newest sounds, but played in a framework that allows you to improvise.
I even saw one of your most recent songs, and I'm sorry, I might be forgetting the name right now, but you use a sword sound.
Yeah, yeah.
Soundbite, sound clip.
So the sword sound is from Assassin's Creed.
Yeah, which is nowadays, you know, it's what we're using nowadays. Yeah.
So, I wanted, like, on stage we use, like, the Mario coin sometimes when I'm singing about money, you know. So I'm like, opolo, is like money, and then I'll hit that Mario coin because people from my generation know when the coin hits, you're getting money in Mario.
So
the sounds, the sword strike comes from Assassin's Creed because we're singing about war, you know. And I also, there's a sound in there from Gods of War as well. But I wanted kids that were, like, tech kids to, like, hear themselves, oh.
Those gamers that I you know, be like, oh, damn, I see it.
You know, and so, it's kind of built like that. It's built to relate to kids, you know, if at all possible. And, you know, I guess I like it, you know, Roomba, for me, example, is I'm a drummer. So I knew I couldn't sit down and if I was to learn jazz, jazz, like, I just feel like that language has already been done to death. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not sure what you can really do with it again. You know, you can... do it again, you know what I mean? But Pharoah Sanders is already there. These guys already did their thing. So
it's been there, it's been done.
I felt that, like, Cuban Rumba offered a quicker path towards freedom, like from a musician standpoint, than jazz did for me. I could learn the nuts and bolts of Cuban Rumba quicker than I could learn jazz composition. Not because it's harder, it's just it's more interesting to me, you know?
Now, have you faced... I know you mentioned earlier this breaking the rules, right? And if you're a musician, you kind of know, you know, your rules of, like, one goes to five, four, whatnot, right?
Sure.
In Rumba, adding the electronic feel to it, have you gotten backlash for, like, breaking the rules?
I mean, I don't, but it's probably because people are maybe scared to talk. You know? But, you know, to a certain extent, like, I kind of said from the get-go, like, what we're doing isn't Rumba because I know I'm breaking enough of the rules that, like, you can't, like, it depends on rules, because if you don't adhere to the rules in Rumba, like, the groove sort of falls apart, right?
True.
So, you know, and that's what makes something very simple work, is if everybody knows how to play the game, right? Yeah. And in Rumba, you need somebody to play clave, you need, you know, the quinto answers the singer, you know, the seguidor and the tumboro have a conversation back and forth, or whatever. There's ways to break it, but there's general things that you don't really want to get away from. Like, it would seem unheard of to play a Rumba without clave, right? Yeah. Like, even though we know that where the clave is, to play it without it would be like...
Yeah, you know, it wouldn't sound right.
Yeah, so, which is funny because, again, like I said, from the get-go, I said I wasn't doing it. I know it's sort of like a get-out-of-jail-free card to a certain extent, but I also know that even though I say we're not playing Rumba, like, if you look at what we're doing, the conversation comes from there. You know, in on the other hand, I suppose... it's my job as a singer and quinto player, this is what I mostly play in the group. I have to be playing on the level of everybody else that's great in Rumba, because you don't get, like, an explanation sheet when you come to the show. Sure. You're just going to see it. And people that know Rumba language, I made this for them too, you know. And so that's the thing. Like, there's levels of engagement. If you don't know anything about Rumba, you can enjoy it. If you do, you're going to recognize the conversations. But it's built to fly.
Yeah.
You know, and the quinto is there to fly. And so in the same breath, we may break the rules, but I have to be playing quinto on the level of every other nasty person out there.
I also think one of the duties of a musician is to be able to storytell. Like, give a nice little story. Without having to, like you said, I'm not going to give you a sheet before the show and say, this song is about this song is about that. You don't want to do that. It kind of kills the vibe.
Sure.
So the one thing that I noticed from just, like, looking at some of the videos that you guys have online and also just checking out your rehearsal is that feeling of a story. Your songs will go from a song of, like you said, like a war kind of song, you know, of what's happening, and then another song about love within the same album, you know, which sure. I think it gives a person, a even if you don't understand rumba, if you don't understand electronic music, maybe you're not even into it, but you still understand the story that you guys are trying to say. And I think that's an awesome way to it's an awesome gift to give to a listener that they're listening to you for the first time. Now, you did mention you're from Indiana, right? So what is an Indiana guy doing living in Puerto Rico now?
Life just led me there, man. You know, I grew up in Goshen, Indiana, which is a pretty small town, you know, close to South Bend, Indiana, a little bit okay. to the east. Yeah. Small farming town, 15,000 people when I was there. You know, then I went to the University of North Texas to study okay. percussion. I was on a drumline.
Small town to a big.
Yeah, to a bigger town, yeah. you know. So I was in Texas, kind of in the Dallas area for maybe 6 years. Mm-hmm. And after maybe four, I ended up getting a sort of snap trip to the Caribbean. I got a free plane ticket to anywhere I wanted to go in the Caribbean, and I ended up going to Puerto Rico. I was there for 2 weeks, and I loved it, man. I saw... it was just striking for me. Yeah. Being African-American, going to a place like Puerto Rico, I'm sort of submerged in Latin culture for the first time, hearing all kinds of music I've never heard before. I'm already a musician, so you know, I'm just eating it up. I hear salsa for the first time, merengue, yeah. reggaeton. But I also heard flamenco, bachata, and then I heard rumba yeah. in the music of the Orishas for the first time as well. Wow. And so it was enough for me to be like, you know, I don't understand why I can't live this life. And so a couple years later, I just kind of got done with the U.S. and I was like, you know what, I want to know what that is. And so yeah. I just picked up and moved, man, and that was in 99, and I've basically been out there ever since.
I'm surprised you didn't go to Jamaica, being that you love
well, that's what I mean is I got a free plane ticket. I didn't want to go to the Caribbean, but by the time I called, Jamaica was already booked out.
Oh.
And so I just ended up in Puerto Rico, man. I didn't know anything about yeah. Puerto Rico.
Wow.
And so it just was it, man. But it's funny, you know, there's synchronicity in my story, I think, as well. Like, you know, the only time I made it out of San Juan, I got to go to a river and sort of spend the day at the river. And the river, of course, is the place of Ochum. And mm-hmm. later on, when I entered the Afro-Cuban religion or the Yoruba religion via Cuba yeah. and Puerto Rico, my patron orisha is Ochum. So
okay.
my first trip, I'm at yeah. the river, man. So I think it makes sense, man.
It's funny, right? Like the way that you know, certain things happen in life are kind of meant to be a lot of time. I see that all the time too, like with just like, you might not think about it at the moment, but yeah. years later on, you're thinking, you're like, man, that was supposed to happen, you know, and it led me to where I am today. And I talk about that all the time yeah. in the podcast, because there was times where you might be going through the worst time of your life, and then eventually later, 5 years later on, you're like, damn, I needed that in order to mold yeah. me to who I am today.
Sure.
I noticed, too, in your music, you have a lot of spiritual meaning behind a lot of the songs. You just mentioned also that you were exposed to the Yoruba religion over in Puerto Rico as well. Can you talk to me a little bit more about that, about your first experience?
Sure. I like, discovered the religion, probably, or practitioners through music. So I was booked to play a Millennium Party in St. Thomas, really, but we were on a ship that went between St. Thomas, St. John, and St. Croix, right?
Mm-hmm.
On the night of, you know, 31st, 1999, right?
Wow.
And so I was DJing, but then there was a rumba group that was booked named Karabali, mm-hmm. And then there was a West African drummer and dancer that were Yoruban that were booked, right? And so we were all staying in one apartment that they had rented for us.
Oh, that's
and
nice.
It was really cool to watch the Puerto Ricans playing rumba and then starting to sing like bata stuff too, because they were singing in Yoruba or Lukumi, and uh-huh. then the Nigerian speaks Yoruba. That's his native
That's
language.
Dope, man.
And so he was just like, he didn't know what to do with
At
himself.
At that one moment, they just became one.
Yeah, 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 yeah. He didn't know what to do with himself. And he's like, wow, you guys sound like my great-great-grandfather. You know,
wow.
And so me being African-American and seeing this group of people that have like in their hands what I've wanted forever. Right,
yeah.
Like which basically means like a straight line back to the mm-hmm. motherland.
Yeah,
they have it.
Yeah.
You know, and I can see it, and they're walking around. They're my neighbors. That was like a powerful experience to me, because you know, we just had so many things taken from us as African Americans that we sometimes think about Africa is like almost an abstraction. Like, we would never go there,
yeah,
you know, and yeah, we know that we had a great history there, but we don't, like, it's like an abstracted thing. Like, we don't really know about it then or now. It's just, you know, hard to grab. And so I never really thought about my history either being something that had to do with the Caribbean. You know, I always just drew a straight line back to West Africa.
Yeah.
But not knowing or not realizing how important the stop in the Caribbean really was, man. And so, yeah, it was powerful. Now, that happened in, you know, 2000, right? Mm-hmm. First day. It's kind of funny that I think about it. All right, the millennium right there. But I kind of knew, or, you know, just on the smell test or whatever, knew that there was a level of commitment sort of required spiritually that I wasn't really ready to commit to. I always saw religion as like a means of control, and that's because I grew up in the Christian church.
Yeah,
you know, and hard as I might try, although there are things to be gleaned from Christian religion, it just seemed like a tool of the oppressor and the colonizer for me always. And so it was hard for me to get anything good out of it, you know. I just saw religion as a means of control because that was my experience, right? So let's say in 2012, I had an ex-girlfriend came to visit me in Puerto Rico, and we were walking around. I said, you know what, I'm really interested in Yoruba religion here, but I can't wrap my head around praying to a rock, and because some of the fundaments inside the religion are stones.
Yeah, yeah.
And she said, why not? And I thought it was the funniest
answer.
Right? Answer. You know what I mean? It's like, wow, well, I guess it's because the world that I understand was defined by Europeans.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
like, I was taught by Europeans to say that this is animate, this is inanimate, this has value, this does not have value.
This is correct.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, and it goes far enough to understand that, like, what we consider magic, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I hear all that talk about bruja all the time.
All
bruja
the time.
Is magic, magic. What we consider magic in the West are things that we don't understand.
Yeah.
You know? And sort of like saying that Africans don't have an understanding of the invisible world is why they call it magic. Mm. But the fact is, they do have an understanding of the invisible world and admit that it exists.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And not only admit that it exists, but have a way to access it. You know? And so in 2012, in 2012, I went and traveled for a little bit and was thinking about moving from Puerto Rico. And I decided to come back to study Rumba, which was something that I always wanted to learn, but never just sat down and studied, because I knew that it was that. You know, you can't, it's like ballet. You can't just like, oh, I'm going to dance ballet.
No, you need to,
You know? So I said, okay, well, I'm going to get a teacher, and I'm going to study, and I would like to try and understand the invisible world around me. And I think the only way I'm going to do that is through this practice, because I think that the practice has some dignity.
That's so dope. I've seen, there was a recent article I read about a couple months ago talking about the influx of African Americans now joining or becoming part of the Yoruba religion because of that, right? It was because they felt that things weren't explained right a lot of times, or they couldn't understand what, you know, the oppressor was giving them or telling them that was right or wrong.
Right.
And also this idea of the unknown was very much hush-hush within the Christian religion.
Right.
So it's funny that you mentioned that, because I feel like after 2000, there's been a big, like, this big opening of being okay to talk about this now, because it was very hush for a very long, even to this day, I think, when people talk about Santeria or anything like that, there's always a negative meaning behind it, or like you said, the magic, automatically, brujeria, and they put two and two together. So I think the fact that you were able to be one of those people that saw it back then, you know, it's a big group of people that have gone through the same. Well, I mean, you tell me, you think it's been a big group of people that have kind of seen this different, especially in the African-American community?
I mean, that's the problem, man. I'm really in a bubble culturally in Puerto Rico, being African-American, living there. I don't, you know, I know who I am and I know where I come from, but I don't really have a squad of brothers and sisters from the States that are with me in PR, you know, and so I don't really know what's happening in the U.S., you know, and the religion is not like this a church that you go to where you see other followers. Yeah. You know, I initiated basically through my godfather, Anifa, who was the first Babalao that I sat down and had a sort of consulting, Orula with this person, and later initiated with him. And he was sort of my only teacher in the religion until I initiated as a Babalao in Cuba.
Okay.
And then sort of entered an Ocha house and then had my Yuvong. This is my second godfather in Cuba as well. And now I'm, learning from more people, you know. But it's a very, like, what do you want to fix or what do you want to work on in your life kind of thing, as opposed to, over here we have, like, church community and, like my folks, like, their whole life is built around, like, their church community.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And so
everything.
Yeah.
So the people you hang out with, the dinners you go to, places you go to.
Yeah. And my experience with the Yoruba religion was a bit more like, what do you need to do to make your life more in sync with destiny? And that was kind of it. Now, I don't know that I don't like to talk about trends too much because I don't think that what I'm doing was necessarily part of a trend.
Okay.
And I don't know if anybody else is doing kind of that. But at the same breath, like, I don't think that there's nothing special about what I'm doing either. Like, what's maybe allowed me to do some of this stuff is that I chose to accept a Caribbean connection that I wasn't aware of. And also made the decision to learn another language, right? So now there's a whole group of people that I can dialogue with, meaning Latinos, that I couldn't before, because in the United States there's sort of like a cultural barriers in between us through institutional racism that likes to keep us apart.
Real big.
And so, I mean,
that was one thing that I was going to ask too, being that did you ever feel kind of odd or felt out of place in Puerto Rico, or was it well received? I'm assuming you were well received because you're still there.
Yeah, I mean, people thought like I was infatuated with race when I came there, right? And it's because my experience was one of extreme segregation, institutional racism. Yeah. So when I was in Texas before I went to Puerto Rico, if I was in a 7-Eleven, right?
It's a big difference. Yeah,
I would go to 7-Eleven, I walk in, there's like, four white people and two brothers over there, right? So I'm definitely going to say hello to the two brothers. Like, and we don't know each other. Yeah. We just like, hey, what's good? Bam, bam, bam. We say hello. We keep it moving, whatever. Yeah. So when I came to Puerto Rico the first time, I remember seeing a group of black people walking towards me on the street, and I crossed over to the street to say hello.
Because
there weren't that many of us on the street. And, I said, hey, what's good? What's happening, y'all? And they were like, look, look, look. And all of a sudden, like, they're speaking Spanish. And I was like, wow, what happened here? And they're Dominican, And they're looking at me like, what is this guy doing? Like, why is he talking to me? Because they might not even consider me black. I just had a whole different way of like looking at the world and understanding how it works and whatever. So yeah, going to Puerto Rico was a bit different. Now again, like, and I had this conversation with somebody else, like, I kind of saw it from the get-go in terms of like looking at a picture of the Puerto Rican Senate, right? I look at the picture and for me they're like visibly all old white guys. That's what it looks like to me. Now, I would never call any Puerto Rican white. Yeah. It just wouldn't come out of. I don't like. I just think about Puerto Ricans as like un grupo étnico. Yeah. Más bien. So the idea that other Puerto Ricans, for example, would say that somebody that was Puerto Rican born in New York wasn't Puerto Rican was crazy talk to me. I was like, no, ¿cómo podría ser? Si eso se yo son boricua. No, se nacieron en el Bronx, ellos no son puertorriqueños.
Son los New Yorkers.
So, I'm being informed about the culture by living on the island, And so for me, trying to be like, no, you guys don't understand, like, the white people are controlling this whole thing. Look at the picture of the Senate. They're like, no, pero eso son
boricua.
Son boricua. It's like, so, okay. So, I had to kind of, like, just re-understand how, people may see themselves, how I see myself, et cetera. So I guess to wind up the conversation, I was talking to somebody else about people talking about wearing natural hair and this and that or whatever. And I was like, yeah, that's great. But I do think that it's kind of a trend right now, in the sense that, like, you know, we were rocking big afros back in the 1970s. That shit went away.
Yeah.
And now it's back.
80s, that, 90s gone.
Yeah. You know, we were rocking, like, there was the X-Clan in the 90s. Yeah, and, like, we, you know, it was very Afrocentric. But that shit comes and goes in waves to a certain extent, right? So there was an author that somebody kind of put me hip to. That's a New York Bawalao, and he sent me something that this woman had written, right? Now, she was black Puerto Rican who studied in the States, and like visibly black, like much darker skin than I am, kinky hair, like there was no, like, you know, there's just no kind of confusing her Africanness, right? Yeah. And she had a rough time in PR, and it's not surprising because it's institutionally difficult. Yeah. You know, there is institutional racism there. However, there's a sense of community and oneness that you don't really see in the States, right? So me coming from there and coming from the States, like, again, in the technical school that I went to in North Texas, we had segregated lunch tables. It's not because there was a white sign on the table or a Latin student sign. It's just the way everybody does it, bro. Yeah. Like, there's a black student table in every cafeteria, and I know which one it is.
And then,
and we all sit there, and then all the Latino students sit here, and all the Asian students sit there, and we just do it, man. And so to come from that to Puerto Rico was like, wow, man, what a relief, sort of. You know what I mean? Sort of. Now the problem is, you know, I understand, like, the viciousness of institutional racism, because I was black and I grew up in Indiana in a small town, right? It was tough, man. But I don't necessarily want to, like, for example, if, let's say I'm a black woman and I have straight hair, right? Yeah. In Puerto Rico, and I say, wow, man, I like this whole natural hair thing. You know, I think I'm gonna, you know, grow my hair natural, right? So she, you know, drops whatever she's doing, grows her hair natural, gets a little afro. 2 weeks later, the bank she works for fires her, right? Because she doesn't look professional.
Yeah.
Now, she doesn't have any recourse like we have in the United States, because there's no NAACP. There's no, like, black organizations that are going to sue the pants off of that bank.
Yeah.
You know, whatever. And so there, we have a problem. Yeah. You know what I mean? Because there's no way to fight it. And you fight it because you have black unity.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And we've gone through all of those things in the States to be able to organize ourselves, to defend ourselves against institutional racism. So that's a great thing. However, I don't want to bring
that type of separation, right? Yeah.
To this island.
Yeah.
We don't need it, man.
You know, it's kind of the same conversation. I heard there's this artist, I'm sure you know who she is, Amara La Negra. She's Afro-Latina, and she's been very big advocate for trying to fight for... she started out as an actress, and she wouldn't get parts because she was dark-skinned, like the lead part, right? She would always get, like, oh, be the servant or be this person. So there's a huge, mostly I've seen it a lot in the New York, in the coast area, starting to come here to Chicago to fight for those in the Latino community that also get pushed back because they're, you know, Afro-Latinos, you know, a little bit more dark-skinned than the rest of the people. And it's funny that you mentioned that. It's kind of eye-opening to see that, because there's no one to back you up now that you mention it. You know, but you also don't want to bring in that weird segregation also that happens as a result of having someone's back.
It's an amazing catch-22, man. And, you know, I feel it on both levels. I really do, man. You know, how can you defend yourself against institutional racism if you don't have black unity? But once you start saying you and I are different, you know, there you go, bro. Yeah. You've opened up Pandora's box right there. And I have another good example is a friend of mine when I was a hip hop DJ. It was like a tall dude that was from Louisa that moved to the States, right, to go to like University of Illinois or something. Right? So black Puerto Rican moves there.
Yeah.
And he has another friend that's sort of looks like you, that's dating a woman that's would probably be visually understood as black, whatever that is, that she moved from Puerto Rico as well. So they're like a couple, right? So he's hanging out with them. Now, he doesn't like the black students at the University of Illinois didn't know what to do with them.
Yeah.
They're like, you know, because culturally we're just, we come from different places.
Yeah.
Man. You know, we, our experience is unifying in many ways, but we come, and so he just didn't feel comfortable, and he felt so uncomfortable that he moved back to Puerto Rico. And he was like, I just can't do it. I don't feel like I fit in anyway.
I've heard that happening so many times.
And I mean, again, I think, like, you know, we're as, you know, as like as people from the diaspora, we're learning that, you know, there is more togetherness, right? Mm-hmm. So this whole the idea of African Americans abstracting straight back to, you know, Africa, I think now we're understanding that our story is spread out,
yeah,
you know, a bit more, and we're open to the Caribbean, we're open yeah. to, you
which
know.
Which is great, man. It's yeah. great to see. I saw there's a festival happening here in Chicago that, I think it's called the Bantu. I might have said that wrong. The okay. Bantu Fest. And it's all, like, you know, everyone, the West Indies, you have Puerto Ricans, Dominicans, Cubans coming in there. People from Trinidad, everybody getting together and having just one festival, as opposed to let's just have the Puerto Rican fest, the Cuban fest,
yeah, yeah.
and it, there's people jamming out bomba music, jamming out. There's some people jamming out some rumba, mm-hmm. and it's just a beautiful mixture, or like a nice little melting pot of what's happening.
Sure.
In society, one of the funny things too, I just came from New York about 3 weeks ago, and being that I lived in Chicago my whole life, I noticed that Chicago is very much segregated. Mm-hmm. And when I was in New York, it was very interesting to me to see how everyone kind of just like lives together in the same spot. And it might sound kind of like, yeah, you know, but it's a big deal for someone like me that has sure. lived in a city where things have been so segregated for so long. Like, you right now, you're like in a Latino neighborhood, mm-hmm. and then you literally go 10 minutes down and it's just African Americans. And then white neighborhood, and you'll see the difference in the businesses that are around.
Yeah, yeah.
When I was in New York, there was like a cuchifrito spot in one,
yeah,
and,
yeah.
and then next door was a halal spot, yeah. and then next door to that, a botanica. Like, I was like, whoa, this is like so weird to me.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
out of, and even my first trip to Puerto Rico when I was a little kid, I remember going to the ice cream shop. It was called Los Chinitos in Ponce, mm-hmm. And the lady was. Looked Asian,
yeah, yeah.
right? And I'm talking to her in English. She didn't know English. Mm. And my mom started laughing. She's like, oh, you know, this is Puerto Rico. Everybody speaks Spanish, and they're part of the community. They're chilling. They're eating lunch with a Puerto Rican, you know.
Yeah,
I
yeah.
mean, somebody that just, to me, will look like a Puerto Rican, right?
Yeah, and I mean, I kind of
it was
did the
not
same
like
thing.
Here, you know?
I did the same thing. I walked. The first time I saw, like, a blonde-haired, blue-eyed woman speaking Spanish, like, with a Puerto Rican accent, I didn't know what to do with myself,
yeah.
you know? So, yeah, man, I mean, and New York is a special place, bro. I, you know,
so different.
That's yeah. why, I mean, I remember loving, like, those 90s Spike Lee films, like, Do the Right Thing, for example.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, there was a guy, I think there was a dude named, like, Caribbean somebody.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
or whatever,
yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? And it just seemed like that whole block was just super diverse, you know? And, yeah, I love it. New York's beautiful like yeah. that, you know? And you see it in films, but I guess being from the Midwest, and even from the South, like, it is very, like,
yeah,
you know.
Big time, broken up into different spots.
You know, I don't know, man. I think it's going to change. But for me, again, like, where I say that I'm not really an anomaly is that, you know, my nephew just came to Puerto Rico for the first time. Now, he doesn't, like, he just loves Puerto Rico because he knows that I'm living there.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So, you know, it was his first time to kind of come to the Caribbean and see what it's all about.
Yeah.
And so, you know, being able to be a bit of an example for this kid, that knowing that I'll probably be maybe the first person that ever presents him the orishas, like, look, this mm-hmm. is what Chango is about,
yeah,
or this
yeah.
is Ochun, or whatever. Like, you know, and knowing that those things aren't so far from his work because his uncle, you know,
yeah.
is right there,
yeah.
you know what
yeah,
I mean?
That como se dice, that closeness to it. He understands it. He
yeah.
won't feel afraid,
exactly.
of it, right? Yeah,
exactly.
It tends to happen a lot too. Like, when I remember my first time, just taking it to music, right? Like, my first time playing in a concert, I was so nervous. And my uncle called me. My uncle's a well-known musician here in Chicago for many, many years. And he's like, "Oh man, don't worry about it, man. I do it every weekend, you know." And that kind of gave me that. So I guess
yeah.
I could relate in that sense.
Yep. Yep.
Back to the music part, though. You went to Puerto Rico '99. You had your first encounter, and then you had. Well, how did you meet the rest of the group? How did Ife come to life?
So again, like, I was traveling in 2012. Decided to come back and study, and I saw the word Ife in 2013,
mm-hmm.
and sort of was like, okay, well, this is what I want to do. I want to make a music that sounds like Love and Expansion.
Yeah.
And I want it to be improvisational. I want it to be electronic, but I didn't know how to do it. And so I was studying Roomba, and I saw that with the nuts and bolts of Roomba, you could make it improvisational and percussive and sort of like, but I didn't know how to do it yet. And then
this was after you went to study Roomba?
This is as I started studying Roomba. Okay. So I started studying in 2013 with a teacher named Sammy Gascott, who's like a great rumbero from Puerto Rico. And he showed me kind of the first patterns for all three drums. And I just would drum from like 9 in the morning until basically 9 at night, 6 days a week. And then I did this. I got so isolated that I started doing 7 days a week. And I did that for about 6 months. And then I traveled again to the States, came back, and I still wasn't really good enough to play with rumberos. I was like, I knew the language, but I was like better than people that had just started, but not good enough to play with the people that I knew because they were great players. So I needed another year of just grinding it out, and so I stayed and grinded it out again for another year. And after like 2 years, like I knew enough to be able to sit down and play in a rumba. I'm not a great rumbero, but I knew enough about the rules of the thing that I felt like I could begin to break them apart to do what I wanted to do with the language. And so during that maybe second year, I sort of had the idea like, look, what if I just change the sounds of the drums and add triggers? Because I had seen a drum set player named, what's this guy's name, man? He plays with Ricky Martin. Tony?
And at that time already, triggers were, triggers were.
Triggers are from like the 80s, bro.
Yeah.
Like early 80s.
But adding it to an actual percussion?
I'd never seen anybody do it on a hand drum before.
Okay.
And so.
Because it's kind of tricky. I mean, if you, like if you slap, I mean, is that trigger going to pick up the slap? You know what I'm saying?
So, here's the thing, right? So Tony Escapi, that's the name of the drummer. So I was playing a jazz gig with him as a DJ and scratching. And I saw Tony. Like, he changed the way his snare drum sounded. He made it sound like an 808 clap, and he made the kick drum sound like, and I just thought it was the coolest thing. And so I called him up, and I was like, hey, man, I want to, like, put triggers onto congas. What do you think? And he's like, yeah, they don't really make them for congas. And I was,
yeah, because if you look at a trigger, well, I don't know how.
A lot of them clip onto the rim of a drum.
It's kind of like a microphone, right?
Yeah, it's basically like almost the same technology they use for a guitar pickup that you stick onto the guitar.
Okay.
So. He's like, yeah, they don't make them for hand drums. But I was like, what do you need? He's like, well, you need like a digital brain, like a drum machine, and then you connect the triggers to that. And so I went to Guitar Center and basically said the same thing. I was like, look, I want to put triggers on congas. And they said, we don't have anything for that. maybe like piezo triggers, which are sort of like these
guitar pickup things. Yeah, like a little microphone,
So I bought a few of those, and I bought like a SPD-SX, which is like a drum machine that you can run triggers with.
The Roland?
Yeah, the Roland. Yeah. I liked it because it was like a sampler. I didn't want to use anybody's stock sounds. I wanted to use my own sounds.
Okay.
And that was a machine where you could like basically delete all the sounds.
And you were connecting that directly over to the triggers.
So, So I bought an SPD-SX and a bunch of triggers and went back to Puerto Rico. And for like a month, I just built sound sets in the SPD-SX. And then I bought a pair of congas from the pawn shop and I drilled holes in them and added the sensors. And
on the bottom, by the rim, or
I drilled a hole to stick the sensor through over here, and then the other start was on the bottom of the head inside it, so you couldn't really see it. It looked like a guitar,
but it was touching the head.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it looked like a guitar where you just plug in a quarter inch cable, and all of a sudden it's electronic.
That's crazy. Yeah, I could just imagine somebody probably looking at the drum like, "What is this guy doing?"
Yeah. Well, I thought. You know, honestly, I felt that I had an original idea, and so I didn't really want to show people exactly what I was doing. And so it kind of helped that, like, I didn't want the actual drum skin to sound, so I just covered the drums up in a cloth.
I saw that. Yeah, I saw that in a couple of videos. So that gives you – that gets rid of that
acoustic
drum
sound, and you're only hearing the sound that the trigger plays, right? So we play in headphones because we don't want to hear any of the, like, the hitting noises we're making. We only want to hear the electronics. So then I also covered up the SPD-SX, so – it wasn't so important. Like, it's not about the gear. It's about what you're hearing, you know? And so...
Yeah, because then a gearhead like myself will start looking at what does he have up there?
Yeah. So, I mean, I did that, and as soon as I plugged it all in and figured out that it worked, like, I knew I had something there, you know? And, you know, the triggers don't really behave like you would want them to. The trigger really just does, like, velocity, so how hard you hit it and when. That's it.
No delay at all?
Not really.
You don't
pretty quick. Now, it doesn't do much for hand drums in the sense that you can't. It doesn't differentiate between a slap or a muted tone or anything like that. So, it wasn't what I wanted, but it was as close as I could get, and I kind of just went with that, you know. So, the first year, you know, we did Tres Mujeres and House of Love, and one SPDX was enough. And then I was like, wow, man, if I had two of them, I'll just have twice the sounds. So I got another one, and I added some more triggers and started putting triggers on things that weren't drums at all. Like, I had, like, a stick, like a big staff, and I just duct taped the trigger to that, and then we use that as like a sound. So,
out of the whole band, are you mainly the one just using the triggers, or is everyone has a trigger on
Everyone there? Is using some form of electronic something other than Beto Lorenz, who's playing shakere. Now, I wanted there to be one acoustical instrument, and so I built the sound so they wouldn't have high-end sounds. Okay. So I'm using the shakere like you would use hi-hats in hip-hop.
Yeah.
You know, and that's it. So, like, in trap, you get, like...
Yeah.
You have like a triplet feel. Yeah, you can do that in the shakere, or you can do whatever you want.
That's dope.
So I just kept that one acoustical instrument, so there would still be like an African root that's super obvious.
Yeah,
you know, and then everything else, what's African about it is the percussive language.
Yeah.
And I also didn't want to like have to explain it to anybody that I was playing with. Like the idea being that if you already know the rules of Roomba and how to play it, you can just sit down at the drums and do what you do. And I'm going to change the sounds, and that's what's going to be different about it. Like, the language is pretty much the same.
Now, as far as the voice or the vocals, are they being manipulated at all, either?
Yeah, they're being manipulated because, I mean, the music I like on the modern end is Jamaican dancehall, and Jamaicans love auto-tune.
With that reverb.
And, reverb and auto-tune and whatever. So I kind of wanted to make it sound like that. And actually, that's actually, like, a trend in, like, current Afrobeat music too, like the stuff that's coming
big time,
you know,
from
the continent. So I wanted it to be in that modern expression, you know, whatever they're doing, we're doing that, but then like rhythmically it's something else. So I guess I also noticed that dancehall uses clave, but they don't really understand that it's clave, right? So in some of the hit songs, like for example, there's one called Miami Vice from Vibes Cartel. Mm-hmm. It goes dun 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 dun. Right, yep. That's what the chords are doing.
Straight up clave.
Yeah, that's straight up clave, you know. And or they'll do one that cycles. They'll go dun 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 dun. So it's sort of like dun dun dun. And they'll give you four. So I do that a lot in like the first couple songs. So House of Love is dun 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 dun. I'll give you the four every other time.
And I also noticed that you guys play around a lot with changing time signatures within your songs.
Sure.
Was that more of your drum aspect behind
it?
Yeah,
because, I
mean,
if you just have these sounds and you're not beholden to any programming or any click, like, you're totally free to do whatever you want at any moment. And that's a great thing about Roomba, too, is a lot of times they'll be playing Wabanko, then they'll switch to Bata, then they'll switch to a Makuta, then, you know.
Different time signatures. It's dope.
Yeah.
I mean, I like that. I remember when I was first starting out in music, obviously, you always want to stay with the 4-4 or whatever. And then eventually you start experimenting with the 6-8 and all these different types of time signatures. And when you listen to bands, one of the genre of music that changes time signature a lot is like metal music, right? And I used to never be into it. I worked at Guitar Center for many years, I was forced to listen to metal. All these crazy time signatures that will come back and forth. Yeah. And for me to hear that from a group that has my style, right, of rumba and some, like, you know, aclave, and you guys changing, I thought it was amazing, man. Definitely, we're getting close to the hour. The man has to eat. He has to get ready for his show. First of all, I want to say thank you for sitting down with us and talking a little bit more on this first show that we're having. It's called Ed Backstage. I think I'm going to keep that name. You guys are here for a couple days. So today is Friday. They're here at the Segundo Ruiz Belvis Cultural Center. By the time this airs, you might have an hour to make it through to the center. So come by today. But you guys are also performing at Navy Pier tomorrow, right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, so they'll be at Navy Pier. Do you know the time at Navy Pier?
I think we go on at like 3. Might be 3.
Okay. We'll put it on the description of this podcast as well. So they're going to be in Navy Pier for those that are listening from Chicago. You guys know where Navy Pier is at. For those that might be visiting outside, Navy Pier, you just look at it in any map in Chicago, and it takes you there. All the trains basically almost take you there as well. So, like I said, I want to say thank you so much.
Oh, thanks
for coming by.
It's an honor.
And for those that are listening, where can they find you in social media?
So the group has a website. It's ife-music. Okay. So like kind of like looks like the minus sign. So ife-music.com.
Mm-hmm.
And then our IG is just _ife. So
okay.
And then the group on Facebook, I think it's /Grupo Ife.
Okay, perfect. So, yeah, like I mentioned, if you guys are in the Chicago area, check out this amazing group. Coming straight from La Isla de Puerto Rico, too. So, woo, it's part of the Borinquen Se Me Llama series that the Segundo Ruiz Belvis Cultural Center is sponsoring. Make sure you like, share, subscribe this podcast. Share it to whoever you think is going to geek out about the music like we did. Once again, thank you so much. Peace and God bless.